It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll find out about the underground world of mushroom hunting. But first, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan released his 2015 budget proposal this morning. The budget, which is called the Path to Prosperity, hopes to balance the federal budget in 10 years by cutting over $5.1 trillion of spending. With me now to flesh out the budget's details is Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a bipartisan nonprofit organization that educates the public about fiscal policy issues. Maya, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with the highlights here. What are the key parts of this budget proposal?
Okay, well, the focus of this budget is basically the same as it was last year, which was the House Republicans wanted to put out a budget that would come to balance over 10 years so that in the 10th year we would no longer be running budget deficits. And the situation had deteriorated since last year. So that meant they had a harder task to do that. I should even back up and say, let's keep in mind that all budgets are political documents and they don't really ever move forward as they are laid out. So in many ways, budgets, whether it's the president's or Paul Ryan's, is a statement of priorities and isn't a very good reflection of what could actually get done. And I would say the same holds here, that this is a statement of priorities for the House Republicans far more than it is that a budget could get enacted. But what it basically does is it has the task of how it would find savings over the next decade in order to get to balance. And as a result, it cuts just over $5 trillion in spending over the next 10 years.
And I understand most of that savings is made possible by the repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
True. By far the largest item in generating that $5.1 trillion in savings comes from repealing the Affordable Care Act. But I should make clear, when they repeal that act, they do keep in place many of the savings that were part of that overall bill. So at the time, what we did was we expanded health care coverage, and that's very expensive. And the Obama administration paid for that through a number of new revenues and reductions in Medicare. Those savings are kept. But the part that expands coverage and pays for it and creates subsidies for the exchanges, all of that is repealed. And all told, that generates about $2.1 trillion in savings.
And other cuts, where do they come in here? Because we've got all of this savings adding up. Some of it is on the back of the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. But what else gets the chop?
Right. So the other biggest pieces of the budgetary savings include block granting Medicaid. And what that means, and this again was in the budget last year as well, it means taking the money that is used for Medicaid, the second largest federal health care program after Medicare, and giving it to the states and capping how much the states would spend. So states would have more flexibility in how those dollars are spent, but they would also have more control and requirements so that Medicaid spending wouldn't grow as fast as it's projected to otherwise. That's the next biggest item. Significantly lower in terms of savings are some other areas, including tort reform as part of health care and some means testing for Medicare premiums so that those who are well off would pay slightly more for their Medicare. Right now, people who receive Medicare in general, overall, the system, get about $3 out for every one that they put in. That's one of the reasons that the system is under such financial pressure. So this wouldn't fix Medicare on its own, but what it would do is generate some savings by asking those who can afford to at the upper end to pay more for covering the cost of their Medicare. Other items that generate some of the savings are increasing federal retirement contributions. Federal workers, generally as their overall compensation package, have very generous retirement plans. Now, that's part of their total compensation, so there's disagreement about whether it should change or not, but that would save about $125 billion over the 10 years. Likewise, the same amount of savings would come from, again, block granting of food stamps, similar to what I was mentioning in Medicaid, but giving more control to the states. Some savings from farm subsidies, some savings from other mandatory savings. And then the two other big items are that we have the sequester. I think everybody's probably heard about the sequester, which is savings in the budget from the discretionary part of the budget. That's the part that goes through the appropriations process every year. Congress decides how to spend the money. It's not the automatic pilot parts of the budget, which are Social Security, Medicare, other programs which we don't budget for. You just get payments if you qualify for them. But the parts of discretionary have been under very severe or strict kind of spending caps since we put in place the Budget Control Act a couple years ago, and then more recently the sequester. This budget would push down on that sequester even more in the out years of the 10-year period. But importantly, it would switch some of the money so that they would dedicate more of it to defense and less to domestic discretionary, which are a lot of the programs people are more familiar with. So science and research and some infrastructure, a lot of investment spending. So they would shift out of that part into defense. And then lastly, there's something called the fiscal dividend, which they count. Normally, typically, that's not counted in budgets. But what this does is they got the Congressional Budget Office to score how much savings would be generated from having a budget that reaches balance. And what CBO, which is a very trusted and impartial analyst in all this, finds is that if you put in place a good debt deal, a debt deal that reasonably starts to control our debt, it actually hurts the economy a little bit in the short run because you're making those tough choices that can shrink the economy. But after a couple of years, it starts to grow the economy. This is called the fiscal dividend, and they count these savings to help them get to balance in the 10-year period.
Now, I want to talk about one of the more contentious things in the budget, changes to Medicare, which includes subsidizing private health insurance for those 55 and younger. Could you talk about that, about where that came from and what do you think it could indicate politically?
Right. So this Medicare proposal, premium support, has been a big part of what Paul Ryan has developed and pushed in the past years of how are we going to reform entitlements. And I should be clear that no matter what people think is the best fix for a Social Security or a Medicare, they cannot be ignored. These are the two biggest programs in the budget, and both of them face serious financial strain. This budget and budget proposals in the House and Senate don't include reforms to Social Security, but it's important to note that this budget doesn't talk about how we should fix Social Security. Couldn't be included here, but you can at least kind of come up with plans. That's something that still needs to be addressed. But they do focus on what changes should be put in Medicare. And the Medicare premium support proposal would basically allow individuals to have more control and choice over how they would spend their Medicare dollars. And they could use that money to buy private plans. And so the argument for it is that it would provide more competition into the system. People would have more choice about the programs they got. And that competition, I think anybody who's familiar with our health system knows there's not much price transparency. None of us really know how much things cost through the insurance markets. But this would help provide some transparency, help control costs. The downside of it, or many people who oppose this, will argue that we don't allow those vouchers or the premium support, the help that we give private families in buying their health care, we wouldn't allow that amount to grow fast enough to keep with inflation so that it would ending up more shifting more costs onto families. Very, very legitimate and strong disagreement about whether this proposal would be good or not. But the main change is it gives more choice to families, more competition into the system. It would be a big sweeping change, and it's not likely in terms of political realities to happen in the immediate future, but it's something that the Ryan budget has included in the past kind of as a way to start having the country talk about whether this premium support or a similar idea would be a good big reform for health care.
Now, you mentioned defense spending, and this budget calls for sort of a beefing up of defense spending right after we heard from the Pentagon various cuts that the Pentagon is hoping to make to the military. Is that sort of the Republican response to that?
Well, listen, there is a song and dance that goes on in Washington every year. It's kind of ridiculous, where the military will talk about the kinds of cuts and places it can come up with savings that it thinks would be sensible, the different branches of the military. And then you see members of Congress going in and overfunding it, funding more than they've been asked for. A lot of times this has to do with jurisdictional or regional issues, I should say, sort of people protecting the money that might flow into their districts or states. So the military is a big budget item. It puts a lot of money into economies, local economies, and it's not always done for the best security reasons. A lot of times you see it for as a way to bring, you know, bring the bacon home to your district. But what the Paul Ryan priority here is, and what their shift to giving more money to defense after the sequester has been taking money out of it, is saying we're concerned that we're not funding the security portion of the budget enough. We need to up those increases. And there will be disagreements and security experts about whether we can afford to spend less on the military. We certainly spend more than all other countries do as a share of the economy. Or whether this is the wrong time. For instance, think about what's going on in Russia and lots of other parts of the world where clearly there are things at risk. This is the wrong time to be cutting back as severely as we are. I guess I say this about every part of the budget, and it's true, big disagreements on this one.
So this isn't a proposal, as you said, that can really go anywhere at this time. It's more of a political document, maybe an expression of aspiration for Paul Ryan at a higher office level. But do you see parts of it coming up again down the road and being picked up on?
Well, I do. I mean, one of the things that's important about the budget is it's very frustrating that when the president puts out his budget or the House or the Senate do, that it's so political and it doesn't lead into discussions of how to put a budget in place. It's worse than it used to be. It's always been bad. The budget's always been contentious. This is one of the areas that the parties used to define themselves. But in the past, at least, it was the beginning of the discussion of how to put in place a budget. And most of the time, the country did. Now what's truly absurd is that this country operates without a budget most years. That is should be terrifying, frankly, to all of us, that we have the world's biggest economy and we operate it without a budget. But the document now is seen as even more political. This year, the House put out the budget. The president put out their budget. The Senate's not even going to bother to put out a budget because, in large part, because last year, at the end of the year, folks may remember that Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, the head of the Senate Budget Committee, came up with a deal, one of the first deals where Republicans and Democrats have agreed on anything when it comes to the budget in recent years. And this deal was to replace part of the sequester cuts, those cuts that are hitting discretionary spending, with some other savings and give us a little bit more room, both in defense and domestic discretionary.
And Maya, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. You're welcome.
We've been talking to Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. A few months back, I spoke with Langdon Cook. He's a self-taught forager and the author of The Mushroom Hunters, On the Trail of an Underground America. He said mushroom hunting is often an invisible world, and a unique culture has sprouted up around it. So I started the interview by asking him what got him into it.
I've been picking mushrooms for probably about 20 years, since moving to Seattle, which is a famously damp place and a great place for fungi. I pick for myself and my friends, and I love to cook with mushrooms. But I also realized after picking for a number of years that there were others out there who were doing this on a professional basis.
Now, mushrooms are a hot commodity right now, and it's actually never occurred to me to wonder. I sort of thought there might be mushroom farms, which I now realize doesn't make a ton of sense with these wild mushrooms that you're talking about. Can you actually make a living off picking mushrooms?
Well, there's some people that are trying. I mean, several thousand, as a matter of fact. And you can move with the seasons in the greater Pacific Northwest 12 months out of the year picking wild mushrooms. So there is the possibility of doing that. And, of course, you have to be a great optimist. You have to be thinking that over the next ridge is the mother lode and that you'll strike it rich. And a lot of them are. And, they pick mushrooms day after day and move with the seasons and camp in national forests. And do what's known as the circuit or the mushroom trail, picking different species at different times. And so I got on the mushroom trail with them.
Now, these are wild mushrooms we're talking about. Can you run us through the list of what's out there?
Sure. And you had mentioned farm mushrooms. And of course, there are farm mushrooms. When you go to the grocery store and you see those little cute white button mushrooms, those are domesticated mushrooms that are grown in farm-like conditions. But the wild mushrooms are really special. They come in all sorts of different colors and shapes and sizes. And of course, they have different taste profiles. And so some of the better known wild mushrooms that you might forage would be chanterelles or porcini mushrooms, also known as king boletes. There's a one that looks like something that might wash up at high tide called a cauliflower mushroom with a wonderful nutty flavor. There's hedgehog mushrooms and yellow feet and lobster mushrooms. I mean, there's all kinds of different wild mushrooms, and they really are a fascinating, almost otherworldly looking sort of pantheon.
Now, in Wisconsin, we get probably the most excited about morels and also lion's mane I've had around here, which are really kind of fun looking. And you're out there in Seattle. Is Seattle sort of the place, the mothership for mushrooms?
Well, we're certainly right in the heart of it all. You know, from Northern California all the way up through Oregon and Washington and BC into Southeast Alaska and then east to the Yukon and down through Idaho and Western Montana, that's really the sort of, you know, that's the area where most of the serious professional pickers are working. But Seattle is certainly right near the top. And, of course, a lot of mushrooms get exported from Seattle and Portland.
Now, you talked about the Mushroom Trail. Tell us what that is.
Well, so as I mentioned, it's the Mushroom Trail is a physical trail. It's the itinerant sort of path that the pickers follow as they follow the flushes of mushrooms through the seasons. But it's also in the book kind of a metaphor. Being on the Mushroom Trail is really finding a, sort of a different way to make a living. Living out in the woods, being in tune with the seasons, wandering around, looking for a type of food that, you know, we have no part in tending. Nature is taking care of these mushrooms, and really our job is to go out and find them. And there's the rub. But I mean, the Mushroom Trail, as it's understood by most folks, is, as I had mentioned, the sort of road for mushroom pickers that extends from Northern California up through Washington and BC into Alaska. And those are the really prime picking areas. And of course, it's famously wet. And also, we have these wonderful volcanic soils out here, which seem to help with the fruiting of the wild mushrooms.
Now, you went along on this mushroom trail with a couple of guys who were really, they were the, I guess, pros at finding these mushrooms. Tell us who you went with.
So I met a picker named Doug, and he graciously sort of let me into his world. Wild mushroom pickers are famously secretive, and you hear all sorts of stories about secret patches and people claiming patches out in the woods and guarding them ferociously and all that sort of thing. But, you know, Doug was very generous with his information, and then he would sell his mushrooms to a particular buyer named Jeremy. And so between the two of those characters, I got kind of both sides of the coin, the picker and the buyer. And I spent a lot of time out in the field with both of them.
Well, tell us about one of the trips that you took with Doug.
Well, Doug and I have been all over the Northwest together, but we also we went down as far as Northern California a few times on what is known as winter pick. And, you know, while most people are, kind of bundled up for the winter and shoveling snow and all that kind of thing. In Northern California, very temperate, you get these mushrooms fruiting, which land on restaurant, plates through the winter, black trumpets, hedgehogs, yellowfeet mushrooms. And so Northern California and southwestern Oregon are the places to pick those. So we headed down probably sometime in January, and we camped in some forest areas. And we actually ran into a few tough customers, which I write about in the book. There was an incident at one point.
I want to hear about that. What happened?
As I had mentioned, you hear these stories of running gun battles in the woods and, you know, pickers who are packing heat and all that kind of stuff. And I really haven't encountered that. But in the middle of the night, while we were trying to sleep, we weren't picking mushrooms. And I don't think these guys happened to be mushroom pickers, but they came into our camping area with some big guns. And there was a lot of there were a lot of rounds going off.
Really?
And we had to make a hasty getaway.
Did they want your mushrooms?
You know, I think they were jacked up on something, and they might not have even known we were trying to sleep where we were. We were sort of hiding, our campsite, but we could hear them. They were nearby, and the bullets were flying, and we needed to get out of there and get out of there quick.
So this is not necessarily a safe occupation all the time anyway.
Well, I don't want to make it sound too dangerous. I mean, that was really one of the scarier things that happened. But, you know, when you're out there in the woods, in the unpoliced corners of the forests, you never know. You might run into a bear. You might run into an unsavory competitor. You just never know. And so those are some of the things that you have to deal with. But mostly, you know, it was just being outside in beautiful places, wandering through the woods, finding these edible treasures, and just being so excited with each find. I mean, it really is just like being a kid again on a treasure hunt in the woods. And that's one of the really appealing things about hunting mushrooms. And I think that's probably one of the motivating factors for the folks folks who do it for a living. It's just, you know, as one guy said to me, it sure beats a cubicle. And, you know, I mean, his livelihood fluctuates, you know, day to day, week to week. You never know when the mushroom flush is going to be off or on and what the prices are going to be because they go up and down with the market. And it's a tough way to make a living. It's hard work. You're walking miles every day carrying a heavy bucket or a pack and, you know, dealing with the weather and all kinds of other things. But for people who want to work outside and be their own boss, you know, it's not bad.
We're talking with Langdon Cook about the underground world of mushroom hunting. We'll have the second part of that interview in just a moment. To get us pumped up for morel mushroom season, we're revisiting an interview we did with Langdon Cook, author of The Mushroom Hunters, on the trail of an underground America. And we've been talking about some of the men and women who make a living picking wild mushrooms. In the second half of the interview, I asked him about the lifestyle of mushroom hunters and what the money's like.
You know, it's a tough way to make a living. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, there are some pickers who do a little better than others, but you really have to be on it all the time, ready to move when the weather shifts, keeping your sort of ear to the ground as far as where the mushrooms are fruiting. You have to be willing to pull stakes and head somewhere else. So, I mean, it is a tough way to make a living. You know, I talked to a picker who said that he picked an incredible morel flush one year. And we have this phenomenon. I know you love your morels in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
We have this phenomenon in the West where after the mountain wildfires, there can be really huge morel flushes the following spring. Mm. And so the pickers follow, they're fire watchers. They keep tabs on where all the forest fires are, and then they start scouting them in the early spring and, you know, hope for that big morel flush. And I talked to this one picker named Bill who said, you know, he was making about $1,000 a day picking a really great morel flush in Idaho.
Wow.
And he was doing that for days, I mean, for weeks, really. And that funded pretty much his entire year. I think he went down to Costa Rica after that.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Okay. If you get lucky, you can hit it pretty big. If you get lucky.
That's right. And you got to be at the right place at the right time. And you have to be able to sort of unravel the puzzle of mushrooms. That's the thing. They're conundrums. They're tricky. You got to understand all sorts of factors that go into their fruiting, from, you know, tree canopy to soil type to weather conditions. All these things work in concert to produce flushes of mushrooms, and you have to understand all the moving parts.
Let's get to the phones now. We have Kathy joining us on Madeline Island. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. One of my favorite subjects on the planet, mushrooms. I've been picking them for about 40 years and never trying to make a living out of it. Have sold them on occasion when I've you know, caught a huge bloom of maybe chanterelles. The morel or the boletes this year were fabulous. But the question I have is I encounter an awful lot of mushroom phobia from folks. They're just petrified that I'm going to have picked a poisonous mushroom. And I have to listen to that story of the mycologist, I think he was in Minnesota, who killed himself with a mushroom he picked. I can't tell you how many times I've had to hear that story. So my question is, when do these pickers cross the line where they are completely accepted for the product they're delivering?
Okay, thanks, Kathy. Thank you for sharing your experience. Sounds so interesting. What do you think, Langdon?
Well, I think what she's asking is what sort of regulations are there to sort of ensure that everybody is and safe and happy with their product. I mean, it's true that this is sort of a new industry. I mean, it really didn't exist much more than 30 years ago. So it's new. The regulators are playing catch-up ball. It is a sort of a freewheeling form of capitalism out there in the woods. I refer to it as one of the last vestiges of the Wild West. And so, you know, you might be surprised to hear that there hasn't been a documented case of somebody buying wild mushrooms from, say, a farmer's market or store that were actually not what they were supposed to be and were poisonous and killed them or made them very sick. It just hasn't happened. You know, most of the really choice edibles are pretty easy to identify. So chanterelles, porcini, black trumpets, hedgehogs, etc., they're relatively easy to identify. And so far, everyone's done a pretty good job, you know, to ensure safety. But I can see, you know, where the caller is going with that. And it does seem at times like there isn't that much apparatus. I mean, you can just kind of browse mushrooms at the farmer's market and look through the baskets and you wonder, you know, who picked these? Where did they come from? How do I know that they're safe? And I guess you're sort of you're trusting the vendor to a large degree in that case.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your call, Kathy. And let's move on to Jonathan in Madison. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
All right, how are you?
Doing great. I just wanted to call and say I've actually gotten into morel hunting the past few years. My friends got me into it, and it's I couldn't have said it better myself when you mentioned it, bringing you back into being like a kid again. I just have so much fun, and it's in regards to what your previous caller mentioned. Sometimes there is a misconception. There are morels that that they look like morels, but they're actually more shaped like a bell mushroom. And those I heard are somewhat poisonous. But I've come across a couple of them this last year. I guess the Madison area was rather scarce. I know the farmers market they were charging upwards of $40-$45 a pound for morels this year.
They were expensive this year. I bought some myself since I managed to miss the season last year. But I'm curious, Jonathan, as a fellow morel fan, what's your favorite way to cook them?
Oh, my favorite way is a lot of people like to like fry them and like lightly bread them and stuff like that. I've tried that, but I you can't get much better than just keeping it simple. If I just put a little bit of butter in the pan, if you prefer, sometimes I'll put some onions in there as well, but don't really eat the onions. Just put them in there for the taste factor. But me, I just straight simple butter and morels, and it depends on how. Sometimes some people like them a little more crispy, but just keep them on a low heat. And let them get to the point where you prefer them, and then eat away.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Langdon, do you have a favorite mushroom?
Well, I was just going to agree there. I think keeping it simple is good because mushrooms have so much to offer. They have so much flavor. And the wild mushrooms, I mean, you start trying these different varieties, and you might think, these aren't really even mushrooms at all. They don't taste what my concept of a sort of a supermarket button is. I mean, they have so many different flavors. They're incredibly meaty. But my favorite, boy, you know, we're having a pretty good pop right now of King Bleets in the Cascade Mountains. And I went out picking yesterday and picked a bucket. And we cooked some of those up as soon as I got home. And, you know, just thinly sliced, sautéed in butter, little sprinkling of salt, maybe just a little herb from the garden thrown on top there. And you know what I like to do is I take a baguette and I slice it thinly and put a little ricotta cheese on each slice and then top that with the porcini that's been sautéed in the butter and then just the sprinkling of salt. And that's it. I mean, the mushroom is what's taking care of that. Porcini, by the way, has just a really wonderful kind of toasty, nutty flavor. And then when you dry it in a dehydrator, it becomes like a totally different mushroom. At that point, it is earthy. And, you know, when you inhale the aroma of it, it just seems like you're inhaling the aroma of the woods. And I use that. I grind up the dried porcini and I add it to soups and stews and sauces. And it really gives a kind of a big base note to those sort of foods.
Oh, you described that beautifully. And you made everyone in the studio so hungry. Sounds divine. Can you ship us some? No, I guess you can't.
Well, dried, certainly.
Wow, that sounds pretty great. You know, I can't think of a better place to leave it than that. Everyone's mouth is watering. Langdon, thank you so much for being here with us today.
And thank you.
That was Langdon Cook, author of The Mushroom Hunters on the Trail of an Underground America. The promise of spring might have you excited to jump back on your bike, but before you hit the road, you should maybe make sure your bike is tuned up and safe for the ride. Hasn't been an easy winter for anything that has to sit out in the cold. Well, Carolyn Weber is with us now. She's co-owner of Coast Inn Bikes in Milwaukee, and she's here to teach us what she knows about basic bike maintenance. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
A lot of us haven't touched our bicycles since we put them away in the fall. And if someone's bike was doing okay, no problems, no issues when it was last put away and ridden, shouldn't it be okay now?
It depends on where you stored it. Like, if you have stored it outside, you definitely want to do more work on your bicycle, whereas if you stored it, like, just in a garage or inside your basement where it's dry and rust-free, you'll probably be in a better spot. But you still should do what I call, like, an ABC check on your bike. And you should do this, honestly, every 3 to 4 rides, just to make sure everything's working okay.
3 to 4 rides. Okay. So what is the ABC check?
So the ABC check stands for air, brakes, cranks and chain, and then quick is for quick releases. So one of the first things you want to check is your air. You want to keep properly inflated tires to what's called PSI, which is if you look at your wheel and look at your tire, you'll see on there, it'll say a number next to PSI, and that's the pressure you want to keep it at. And if you don't keep it up at that pressure, you can get flats a lot more easily. 9 times out of 10, you can prevent a flat just by keeping properly inflated tires.
Okay, so that's the air part of it. And the B is brakes. Yep. That seems important.
Yep. So for brakes, you want to just check your pads for wear. So when you look at the pads, you're going to see if there's less than a fourth of an inch left on it before you hop on your bike for the spring. You're going to want to get some new brake pads from your local bike shop.
Okay, so there should be a quarter inch left, is that right?
At least a quarter inch left.
Okay.
And then you also want to just check to make sure the brake levers brake properly and that the pads actually contact on the rim. And then if they're feeling too loose, that's something else you want to get checked out as well.
Okay, so brakes are key to bike safety. And what about the C part of your ABC checkup?
So that's for the cranks and chain. So the cranks are where your pedals are attached to, and then the chain is actually what makes the pedal or the bike move forward. So one of the things you want to do is take both of your cranks and try to pull them away from the frame. And if they have any wiggle when you do that, that will also need some adjustment as well. And that's just going to get more and more loose, and then you can go from a $5 adjustment to like a $40, $50 fix. So it can save you a lot of money just by checking that. And then for the chain, you want to make sure it's not too loose. There is a fit, like a tool that we use. You can put it on the chain check it. If you don't have one at home, what you can just do is take a look at your chain and see where it wraps around that front crank. And if it's a little bit loose, it doesn't contact it, a nice snug wrap, that might mean your chain is stretched out. So if you just go get a new chain, you can put a new chain on there. That'll help prolong the life of your drivetrain a lot. All those parts will keep going a lot smoother. And then you also want to then also apply some new lube on it about every 2-3 weeks. If it feels dry, you need some new lube.
So what happens over the winter in the garage? Is it just the expansion and contraction of the cold that makes everything get a little out of whack?
Exactly, yeah. It can be for your tires, you'll probably have them deflated over cold, and when it's too cold and it's too hot, they'll cause the tires to lose inflation. A lot of times we'll get bikes into the shop and they'll be like, oh, I have a flat tire. It's like, oh, you just need some new air. And then if you have your bike sitting in a corner garage, sometimes there's moisture in there, and that moisture can get in and sit in there. And that grease can just stiffen up. So it's just getting everything moving again.
So if you have the luxury of a basement, are you better off putting your bike in the basement than leaving it in the garage?
Depends how dry your basement is.
mine's
not too dry. Yeah, so, I mean, I prefer keeping my bike in the basement just because, at least with us in Milwaukee, we have a high theft area of bicycles. So I don't, unless I can lock my bike to a ring in my garage, I typically bring my bikes down to the basement. They just keep drier down there, and I know they're more secure. I can keep an eye on it a little bit more.
So what else should we look for?
Some other things you want to look for is your quick release. That's the quick part of the ABC quick check. And so that's what attaches your wheel into the bike. Oftentimes you play with those when you take your bike off and on the car, usually, or inside a car.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to make sure those levers are nice and tight and that they're against the frame. Otherwise, what would happen is that they spring out. If they're not completely down, as you start pedaling, your wheel might fall out.
That sounds
bad. It wouldn't be very good either.
Yeah.
Generally is.
And in terms of whether or not we can do this ourselves, is this stuff you're describing something that I could do given, you know, a trip to the hardware store to get the right tool, or is this something you're better off just taking to the pros?
I always recommend taking it to the pro if you feel confident about it. But a lot of these simple things you could do yourself, like, for example, cleaning up and relubing a dry tree claim. So doing quick degreasing and putting on a new chain lube is something you can very easily learn yourself. You can watch a couple of YouTube videos. I do encourage people to purchase tools or supplies from your local bike shop, because then it actually will, it keeps the bike shops afloat. But then also it creates a relationship with that bike shop, and you might get somebody at the shop who might just teach you how to do it then, because you're working with them. And then also there are places often in your communities where you can go and learn bicycle repair. Like here in Milwaukee, we have the Boys and Girls Club, Milwaukee Bicycle Collective. We also have Vulture Space. Now, are these places where people can go and just donate a little bit of money and they'll teach you how to work on your bike? So you can do it at home and on your own. That's actually how I got started learning bike repair that way.
Well, let's say that winter was unkind to your bike and you've got a flat. Can you fix it at home? How do you do that?
You can. You're going to need two tire levers. You're going to need a pump. I prefer usually a floor pump because it's a lot faster and it doesn't pull off the valves as much. And then some people use air compressors as well, and that's fine to use one of those at home. And then, so what you're going to, again, YouTube is a great resource. You can look up YouTube how to change a flat, and it'll show you how to use those tire levers to pop off your tire and inspect your tube for where the flat is, and you can put a patch on it. And usually when you buy a box of patches, you get about 5 to 10, depending which one it is. And then you just put that tube back in, and you just put the tire back onto the rim. So after that's one of the things I most commonly teach people is how to change your own flaps, and they can do them at home. And you can usually just do it by turning your bike upside down, and you can pop the wheels in and out.
Now, one of the things that some bikes are cropping up with after the winter is rust on the chain or on the joints. What happens when you've got a rusty bike? What do you do?
I would wipe it down with some soap and water and just give it a good cleaning. One product that I really like to use is Simple Green, actually, and that can help get a lot of that rust off and get all the salt and crud or whatever's sitting on there.
Simple Green soap, is that what it's called?
Simple Green, it's a degreaser. You have to buy it at the hardware store. We go through a lot of it here at the shop. It's an environmentally friendly degreaser. Doesn't hurt you. You can put it down your drains. And then that'll take care of a lot of the rust on your chain and get everything wiped down. And then after it dries, and always reapply some new lube, because lube is actually good on a bike. It keeps things moving. So you want to put some new lube onto the chain and then onto your pivot points of your derailleurs, into your brakes, and places that things move around. And that'll help get all the rust off, and that new lube will keep things from sounding creaky.
Well, now that you've taken us through some of the steps on tuning up the bike before we get on it, I suppose riding a bike could be like driving in the first snowstorm. You kind of forget what you're supposed to be doing out there on the road. What are some things that bicyclists forget in terms of safety when they start riding again in the spring?
Some things. Remember that you're in Wisconsin. You're supposed to follow the rules of the road. You know, you're supposed to stop at red lights as well. You should stay to the right of the road, use the bike lanes as possible. Just remember to take it easy. I always encourage people to use a helmet. It helps keep your head. I mean, it doesn't help in all cases, but it helps in most cases if you do fall or something happens. And if you ride at night, it's particularly important to have lights on your bike, even if they're safety lights, but for something for drivers to see you. A great resource for more information with commuting and being safe on the roads is the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation. And they have a great website that goes over a lot of this, as well as like a daily blog that talks a lot about issues and being safe on your bike.
It seems like there are always groups of people who are riding without helmets. I don't know if that's a new trend right now to go helmet free, but what do you see as someone who runs a bike store about, you know, what can go wrong when you're not wearing a helmet?
As somebody who has fallen and have, you know, a helmet has helped me, not like had a concussion. Then, like, you know, if a car hits you at 30 miles an hour, there's not much you can do about that. But I have had many friends who have been hit over the years, and helmets have helped them. So as an owner of a bicycle shop, I encourage everybody to wear a helmet. When I rent bikes at my bicycle shop, I encourage people to take the helmet and not sign off that they don't take it. I think when I hear a lot of people who don't wear helmets, one, it's not required in the state of Wisconsin to wear one. But two, they don't like wearing it because they don't like the helmet hair, or they don't like how they're, you know, how it looks. And I encourage them to go to a shop and try different types of helmets. Different ones will fit differently. They are making them very light now. And when I commute to work, I actually teach as well. I just bring a comb with me. You know, you bring some hairspray, you can fix up your hair when you get to work, you know. And people, and often women do this anyway, right? or guys, you usually fix up your hair anyway throughout the day.
Right, so like, if a comb and hairspray is going to help you wear the helmet, it's probably a good thing.
Exactly. And now they're making them very stylish now. In fact, they're releasing ones that look like hats now. So they even look like you're wearing a helmet. Hmm. They make them in fun designs, different colors. They're not this, you know, there's not one type of helmet you can wear. You can wear a lot of different ones.
Carolyn, have you been out there on your bike yet so far? Or are you still waiting for your first spin?
I've been riding all winter still.
I had a feeling you were going to say that. Do you put the studs on your tires and kind of just go for
it? Exactly. You put studs on your tires. I ride a winter commuter bike. That's a little bit more. I don't mind the salt on it as much. And, you know, you just wear a little bit more layers and you just ride every day. I am looking forward to the nicer weather here. It is still nice to be able to ride a road bike again.
What is your favorite spring ride in Milwaukee?
Let's see. One of my favorite spring rides in Milwaukee is probably going down to Bayview down in Grant Park. It's a fun ride down there. It's a beautiful park and it's a very windy, long road that you could take a long road ride on.
All right. Well, happy biking, Carolyn. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great day.
That's Carolyn Weber, co-owner of Coast in Bikes in Milwaukee. And she was with us to teach us how to tune up our bicycles for the new riding season.